Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, I felt like we just spoke last night.
Yes, Mark. And I think we're going to be speaking quite a lot. But guess who we have on our show today?
Oh. Is it Leon Rodriguez?
Damn, how did you know?
Because he's right here. Hi, Leon.
Hi, how are you guys?
We are doing well. Let me go ahead and introduce you to our listeners. Leon Rodriguez served as the director of USCIS from 2014 to 2017, following an over 25-year career as a prosecutor, law firm partner, and government agency leader. To break this down even simpler, Leon was the USCIS director during the Obama presidency.
That is true.
Leon, we have one topic that is on everybody's minds, the regs. And we have you to thank for the regs. Yes?
Well, yes, on a certain level, yes, in the sense that the notice of proposed rulemaking for what is now a final reg was actually first issued in mid-January of 2017. So literally days before the conclusion of my tenure at USCIS and the inauguration of President Trump.
So yes, the regs were executed on your watch. So we have 101 questions for you, Leon. So I hope you are ready.
I will answer all of them, except for the last one. But yes, all of them.
Number one, timing. Why? We're all amazed. Why are these regs coming out a month and a half before we think we're going to actually get draft legislation through?
I think they're coming out precisely because there is draft legislation coming through at the end of September. I mean, if you will look at the history of what has occurred since actually before the issuance of the NPRM that I just mentioned, and what has continued now every time the legislation comes back up again, is we think we're moving toward some deal that really harmonizes the various interests both up on Capitol Hill and within the EB5 industry, and there is no deal. I don't know why. I've heard rumors, but I don't know why. But I know that there hasn't been a deal.
Okay. I know, that seems to be the case, but there has been an issue each and every time. There has been something within the draft legislation which one party or another doesn't like. But because, we are part of IAUSA leadership and we are really heavily involved with this current draft bill, I can tell you this is the one time in the history of EB5 that we have all the stakeholders on the same page. To quote someone, all the stakeholders are singing from the same songbook.
Well, one question I guess I would pose back to you is, does USCIS know that, and do they believe it, and do they care? Because, again, I really view this as more of an insurance policy on USCIS's part than I view it as actually the policies that they intend to ultimately implement.
Well, there have been more than one closed-door meetings between USCIS and not only IIUSA, but all the other stakeholders that we are aware of. So they do know. I think the issue probably is that do they care? But what I actually feel is that they feel that if they can get their TEA rationale and they can get their the figures that they want, the 950 and 1.8 through the door, then they've achieved what they want to achieve, because the current deal that everybody has agreed to is that the TEA differential is only 100,000, not 900,000.
Right.
That makes a huge difference when it comes to investing.
Clearly it does. And look, everybody knew that. Both USCIS knew that, and everybody in the industry did that. And so, we still have to ask ourselves, what is the agenda on the agency's part? Partly, we need to look at the influence that players on Capitol Hill maybe playing within the administration and what their agendas might be to, in terms of where they want to position an ultimate deal and how they would like that to end up. And I think that this regulation is part of their strategy to, it's insurance. I really think for them, it's insurance to make sure that there is, in fact, whatever is now agreed upon, that there is, in fact, a deal at the end of September. I think the one thing USCIS would not want is to actually implement this regulation in adjusting its system, adjusting its manner of conducting adjudication.
I think we lost Leon.
Yep. That's never happened before.
I got cut off. I am so
sorry. Oh, there he is.
Okay.
Okay. You guys will love this. My my daughter placed a time limit on my social media use. Time limiter went into effect.
That's so funny, Leon.
That is awesome. Can we somehow make that analogy for this episode? Your daughter put a time limit for social media on your device, and here we are talking about the regs and the timing that they implemented. You know, I may not even edit this out.
I think basically somebody is now putting a drop-dead mechanism on the issuance of this legislation. I firmly believe, even with everything that Mona has shared, which I don't have the inside scoop that she does, I still believe that that's the motive behind this.
Well, we were really confident. Actually, before the regs came out, I was very confident just because of the players who are out there. I mean, we have Senator Lindsey Graham and Senator Cornyn and Hakeem Jeffries. We have people from both sides in the House, in the Senate, who are backing this bill. Just because they need to see, we need to have changes in EB5. We need to have some more security with all of the integrity measures and things. But it's the TEA issue, which is really going to hurt a lot of the projects. And this is one of the questions I wanted to ask you, Leon. In the regulations, USCIS state that 53% of the present projects will be affected. In drafting these regulations, did you guys not think or consider what would happen, project failures, or what would happen if projects just couldn't get investors?
What I can say is what occurred in terms of time. Basically, through the spring and into the fall of 2017, there was correspondence, it's public correspondence, between the Department of Homeland Security and Senator, and the one senator you didn't mention, which is Senator Grassley.
Uh-huh. I didn't mention him deliberately.
I think his influence, his agendas with respect to EB5 are still very much a driver in what goes on.
Yeah.
And among the concerns that were expressed at that time was this concern about gerrymandering of TEAs and the notion that TEAs really did not, which, by the way, I think the evidence doesn't necessarily support that fear for what it's worth, but the notion that TEAs do not provide an economic benefit to distressed areas, that in fact they're gerrymandered in a way that then brings the economic benefit to what are otherwise already prosperous areas.
I understand. I've heard this argument and I understand the rationale behind it. However, I think we have proved that over and over again that a lot of the projects in these rural areas, in the distressed areas, just don't pay back. So you're expecting somebody to put their life savings into or their money into a project and just never get paid back, because that really has been proven.
Well, you know, the fact is one of the most important things that the EB5 program accomplishes is employment. And we all travel for employment, regardless of our income level. So you could have somebody traveling from a less prosperous part of town to a more prosperous part of town and now has a steady job as a result. And that is the kind of benefit that was part of the EB5 agenda. I certainly have always hoped for a much more nuanced view, a much more real-world-based view on how economic benefit is created. Now, you also, again, we have to come back to Senator Grassley, and we also have to think about what his legislative agenda has been. And it has, as far back as anybody remembers, been focused on rural areas.
Yeah.
There have been talk about rural set-asides and this and that. You know, that's really related to the TEA issue, but it's distinct from the TEA issue because it's its own subset of potentially distressed areas. You know, that's certainly not part of this regulation. specifically to bring a benefit to rural areas.
Well, I agree that the intention was that the TEA amount should go to the rural areas and the gerrymandering has been unfair. I totally agree. And that's speaking from someone who is in New York City and we have a lot of New York City projects. But I do think that there are things within this regulation that I don't see working. I don't see it really working that USAS will be able to accurately designate the TEAs. We don't even have any idea whether they're going to do it before or after they adjudicate the 526. How will we know that a project is in a TEA? There's a lot of uncertainties. And the regulations themselves are just, I know they were bifurcated, but these particular ones, there's a lot of things missing.
Well, one of the things that we have to ask ourselves and be concerned about, and Mona, certainly you and I, because this is part of how we make our living, is what will the industry do in response? Will there come a point where developers in particular say that citing my development, particularly around the location of a TEA, just doesn't make sense for me anymore? And, you know, that's something that I think we all need to be worried about, because that, of course, would then spell doom for the program overall. You know, the project developers no longer thought it worth their while to be particularly citing their projects in particular places.
Well, I think that is one of the issues, because in the midst of an offering, you know, November 21 may kick in. Investors are still pending their 526 adjudications after the effective date. The project can no longer move forward due to a lack of funding. I mean, it really would hurt all the investors pending in that particular project. And they wouldn't be able to use their priority date because there isn't a priority date retention. So I do see that there's a lot of gray areas that USCS have to pick up on. But one point I think is important. I always like to see the good side of everything is that for 2 million, you only need to do 10 jobs. 1.8. So, you know, we are looking at a different type of investor. We are looking at a different type of project. And in that respect, we're looking at a different type of industry and the cottage industries which grow up around this particular industry. Was that the intention?
I think it was far more mechanical than that. I mean, you know, it's what it says in the preamble to the rule. I mean, I think we're back on the investment thresholds, right? We're not talking about the TEA designations per se.
Yeah.
And I think that was really just purely based on inflation and just a legal view that the investment thresholds, because of inflation, were essentially obsolete.
Mm. Well, the thing is that there is a commentary in the regs that they have considered the UK and Australia and New Zealand, etc. But in those programs, the amount is not at risk. The money is guaranteed returned. Here, we're talking about an at-risk amount.
Right, which means the investors could lose that money. It's greater. I mean, one of the things that I've learned practicing in this field and traveling overseas, meeting potential investors, meeting the migration agents overseas, is that the economic profile of the typical investor is not what people think.
Yeah.
In the sense that there is an image of somebody who's got the amount they're investing and plenty more after that. And that this is just literally this way to just buy their way into America. In fact, I don't think I've seen a single EB-5 investing family that looks like that.
Exactly.
In fact, what I more typically see is families that are practically using every last in order to be able to make the investment. And the motive is basically for their children to be able to come to the U.S., go to school and live their lives here in the U.S. You know, rarely is the investor themselves the real stakeholder.
That's totally right.
Their children. So the way EB-5 has been portrayed publicly, I don't think that's something that's really been seen, that's really been understood about who actually pursues EB-5 investment.
Right. And also the side benefits of EB-5, which is all the extra money which has come in because of these investors bringing their children in and letting the children go to university here and buying property, etc. But what's your opinion, Leon? I mean, you must have had a look at the regs and you know, I don't know if they were the same as what you had envisaged before you left USCIS, but what is your opinion of them as they stand today?
I think the TEA designation issue, as I sit here today, is an issue that's going to present real difficulties, as you have suggested, as we've discussed, for the industry. I think the industry has already made their peace with that.
Yeah.
I also think that the fact that, you know, with retrogression, we are now in a position where the who the investor is starting to shift in terms of what countries they're coming from and will come from. I think the market's going to evolve in a bunch of ways. I'm particularly interested to see what happens in Latin America, because with all of what continues to be significant political instability in places like Venezuela and other places, that has already created a market. I think what has not fully developed is an industry that is as all-encompassing as the one that we saw in China. But I think that's possible.
Yeah.
You know, in that environment, the $900,000 and whatever the legislation turns out to be, probably somewhat closer to $900,000 than what the reg has, may not be as much of a stretch as it would appear is the case in a lot of the Asian environment.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I don't believe it. The 900 will dampen as much as the TEA would. But I think that the way that EB-5 had developed into basically being an alternative source of capital for developers in cities like New York and Miami, I think that part has definitely going to change. I don't believe the speed will be the same, the speed of raising money. And interestingly, we've seen a lot of different industries come in recently, IT and technology, pharmaceutical, you know, things which you wouldn't normally associate with EB-5.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I think there's a reason why that didn't develop. You know, obviously, it is easier to not only maintain job creation, but to demonstrate job creation in a brick and mortar industry. You're building something, you need people to build it. If it's a hotel, you need people to work in the hotel. Those things are a lot more fragile in other industries. The ability to demonstrate what you need to demonstrate, particularly from a job creation perspective, to sustain the project. But having said that, I think it's far from impossible. And so I do think, you know, we could see evolution away from that. But the other thing about the reg and the legislation that I think needs to be mentioned, and I remember I promised the day I stepped out the door of USCIS that I would always talk about this, is the overall numbers are still woefully low.
Yeah.
So 10,000 derivatives separately counted toward that cap, at least so far. It doesn't look like we're going to be able to challenge that legally. That's still a problem. And that means that whatever legislation comes out in September, I think a lot of us are going to find it necessary to revisit this issue before very long, because those numbers are not realizing the full economic benefit of the program.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think everybody would echo that. Liam, one question. We have seen a slowdown in USCIS's adjudications for the last 6 to 8 months, a complete slowdown. Is it because of these regulations? Is that the reason?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Well, it's just, you know, remember, we're seeing slowdowns in USCIS across the board. So that's not just in EB-5, although EB-5 has been particularly severe compared to other product lines. But you look at citizenship, you look at adjustment of status, you look at pretty much every category for USCIS. I think there was just testimony from AILA that 96% of all adjudication categories are now substantially more backlogged than they were 2 years ago. That bespeaks a number of factors, not just the fact that this is one area where there are pending policy changes. I think it reflects in part what we're seeing all over the immigration system is an increase in anti-fraud measures by the government, greater scrutiny of the bona fides of applications, more requests for evidence. I think those are also factors that are driving this great increase in processing times.
Because I was surprised that there was no concurrent filing on this, on the regs, because I know it had been discussed earlier, and I know it's in the draft legislation. And if you're asking someone who's put millions of dollars in investments here, and then they have to wait for years before they can even get entry into the country, it just seems very unfair.
I mean, they're trending away from concurrent. Again, it's another thing that is in line with things happening elsewhere. So there is talk now of eliminating concurrent filing in other areas as well. So not just not implementing it for EB-5, but actually rolling it back in those areas where there is concurrent filing.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You know, I hate to say it, but it does appear that the intent of this administration, this current leadership of USCIS, is to make things harder pretty much at every turn.
Yeah, yes. Right. I was about to give you a sarcastic remark, but yeah, absolutely. It's the harder is not the word. It's getting impossible in some areas. But I would still suggest to USCIS or anyone who's listening that there should be something for someone to be able to at least come into the country prior to 2 or 3 years if they're going to put this much money in an investment.
Well, it also actually, interestingly enough, it saves USCIS resources because you're only opening that file once instead of twice. A lot of the issues that you're going to be looking at as far as the core bona fides of each filing are the same. So there's actually efficiency to be realized if you do it in a concurrent filing. So it's really too bad that they're trending away from that approach.
Leon, can the regs be stopped? Is there anything that anybody can do right now that would just stop the implementation? I think that's a huge question that everybody wants to ask.
Yeah, I'm not seeing where there's a legal challenge, but I assume there's a lot of smart lawyers among our colleagues who are thinking about, is there a legal challenge, some sort of Administrative Procedure Act challenge? I assume those discussions are going on. The thing that will stop this regulation dead in its tracks is a bill, congressional legislation. That is the one thing that could happen. You know, the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, right now, you have a November, I think it's November 21 or like 20, 4 months out. That is a really long effectiveness window
for
regulation. I've issued a lot of regulations in many years in the federal government in a lot of different areas, and that's the longest I've ever seen. And the thing is, even with that, if the administration decides it wants to wait even longer to actually implement the regulation, it can do that, and probably nobody will challenge the administration for doing that. Can stretch it out even further if that makes sense tactically to them. But I think everything here is trending toward there being some final legislative agreement. It sounds like certainly from the industry side we're there, and that is going to really obviate this regulation altogether.
We have to say that this is one comment that we all made, that 120 days was long. We expected 30 to 60 days.
Yeah, I think it's to give room for the legislative jockeying to occur.
Interesting.
Leon, you've held many hats in your 25-plus year career, including the director of USCIS. So let me ask you, imagine yourself in the role of an EB-5 project developer, and these changes have just been announced. What would you do, Leon, as an EB-5 project developer? What would you do in the next 4 months? And what kinds of plans would you make beyond that four-month period?
Well, I think one thing that I would do as a project developer, and I assume this has already begun to happen, and that is, you know, if I have something that is not fully subscribed, I might double down on my efforts now to make sure that that project is in fact fully subscribed. And so, you know, I think one thing we're going to see in our industry is on the investor side, I do think we're going to see a little bit of a spike in activity, maybe a big spike in activity between now and November, because I think there is going to be some mentality. I imagine some of our colleagues will do everything they can to stimulate that mentality. You want to lock in at the better level. And so that's something that I think is certainly going to happen. I think project developers will want to accomplish the same outcome. I then think there will need to start developing strategies for how, you know, what happens if we do need to live with this in the future.
And
the initial reaction, you know, could be to say, well, forget about it. There's other ways to make a living. There's other places I can build my project. And I don't have to make myself crazy just so I can be in a TEA. So I'm done with that. I don't want to do that anymore.
Well, that's a great segue, Leon, to a question that I wanted to ask, that people have been saying over and over again, that if these regs come in, it's going to be the death of the EB-5 industry. I personally don't believe that. What's your opinion?
I think there will be a realignment. I mean, because the one thing that's not going to change is EB-5, remains easy capital. You know, it remains relatively cheap capital. That's not going to change. So as long as there are investors out there, there are going to be, let's call them business people. Let's maybe move away from focusing, and then I think you had already taken us down this road, Mona, focusing on developers and focusing on construction and real estate, and realize there are a lot of other models for how money can be invested within the new TEA framework. And I think there will be a new, maybe a whole new class of entrepreneurs out there that comes forward and says, we actually know how to work within this. This is capital that can help us create new enterprises. We think we know how to show job creation. And, the industry may very fundamentally realign. But, as long as it's cheap capital, I think there are going to be people who are going to want to pursue it.
Well, cheap capital, and secondly, people who want to come and live in the United States. And I think there is always going to be that as well. So I don't see the death of the industry at all. I just see a complete reshaking and remodeling of the industry.
Yep, I think so. And in a way, that's exciting. And in a way, also necessary, because I think there are things that were happening more related to retrogression that were starting to put the real squeeze on the industry. And this could cause us all to think about, what does the new world look like? How do we continue to realize the benefit of this program outside of the old China-based, real estate-based model, and now look at a much more global approach to using EB-5?
Yeah, exactly. That's always been our focus, because I never liked it to see like it's just a mill. That yes, you can invest in a project which is another 100 or 200 people and nobody really knows anyone. I always feel like the entrepreneur program using regional centers can have so much more potential than it's currently being used for. So, I mean, if that was Senator Grassley's vision, then I do applaud that vision. I'm just not sure about the whole TEAs.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing here, one of the things that has always surprised me is that you don't see far more involvement. I mean, there's some, but that you don't see far more involvement by local governments in particular in taking advantage of the benefits offered by EB-5.
Right.
Do you think that's going to happen more now that they no longer have any influence on the TEA designations?
I think even without being able to influence the TEA designations, it still doesn't preclude them.
Oh, certainly not.
From hosting regional centers, right, promoting projects overseas, there is a way that they can operate in this.
Let me ask you this. Since you've been the director of a federal organization, imagine you're a director of a local state government or local city government organization, and these new EB-5 changes came out, and the TEAs are now designated at the federal level. So that's easier for you, right? You can easily point to a directory and say, this is a TEA and this is not. So, Leon, putting yourself in the shoes of a local director of a government organization, what would you do with this?
Well, it's interesting because even in the local government world, there are haves and have-nots. Mm-hmm. There is a certain amount of, local and state politics that, naturally goes into the existing designation of TEAs.
And imagine that would probably happen at the federal levels and things as well now.
Well, much less susceptible to influence, because now you're, basically going to have this federal bureaucracy that's not even federal politicians. It's basically a federal bureaucracy now that's going to make these decisions.
The civil servants, right.
But that actually may mean that poorer cities might actually end up advantaged, or poorer municipalities may have actually a greater foothold than maybe they do. I don't know.
But okay.
I mean, it's something at least need to entertain that possibility as we look at what a different future might look like.
So it sounds like if you were director of that local government organization, the advice I'm hearing from you is you would then entertain that possibility of EB-5, see how it could benefit your region. If you've been federally designated as a TEA, you would say, hey, look, here's an opportunity, a decreased opportunity from the past. So there's fewer TEA opportunities, but I happen to be in a local government organization that is in one of these new TEA designated by the federal government. How can I use this EB-5 program to help the local economy?
I would pull in my director of economic development. I would sit him down. I'd set up a regional center, make sure we operate 100% above board, that we'll be able to withstand scrutiny, go buy yourself a plane ticket to go to take your pick of where investors might be. And, you know, let's start inviting people to know about the beautiful benefits of our area and the great opportunities.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one door actually, which has been opened by EB-5 and carried on by other countries where citizenship by investment is so prevalent, which I do not believe will close. Because I think as time goes on, I think it's just going to be more and more apparent that, yes, there is a way to the United States through investment.
And to use that door analogy, Mona, using Leon's case, that local governments could then use EB-5. I see that as a door that swings two ways. I see EB-5 professionals and attorneys and other people that work in the EB-5 space utilizing the new TEA designations and then going to local governments and say, hey, did you realize that you are now one of the few TEAs in America? Here's EB-5 and here's how I can help you to get the most out of it. So yeah, I see that as a two-way door.
Yeah.
Leon Rodriguez, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was really an enjoyable conversation.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshahlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.